Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
And now Stanley Aronowitz, who has been described as the most important scholar on the past and present of the U.S. working class, whose latest book is The Death and Life of American Labor, joins us to fan the flames for a new workers' movement.
We are going to rise again. Is that not correct, Stanley?
We may rise again, depending on whether people are ready to take risks. Yes, we're going to rise again because some people are ready to take risks. Our unions today do not like to take risks. They will cuddle up to the public bureaucracy. They'll cuddle up to the private employers because they don't want to strike. They don't want to take direct action. They don't want to really fight for what is workers' needs. But if people start to do that, if they start to fight, then things might change. Yes, that's the argument of my book, that people will have to make the kind of fight that has always been important from the 1880s through the 1930s, through the 1960s, that made the labor movement what it became. But what has happened now, I would think about 40 years, is that the labor movement is declining even as we speak, because people are interested. They have what I call the security bug. What matters is whether I have a job, whether the job has security, whether I have benefits, and the union becomes a insurance company. Now, I don't think that that's entirely true of all unions. It's not true of all locals or all struggles, but it's been true to a large extent of the labor movement as a whole.
It's a tough nut to crack, and that is winning economic strikes. We've got this allegiance with the Democratic Party that the organized labor groupings just won't shake loose. And we have still the right to work in the South laws that have certainly not been really challenged in any major way. All of these things. So who really is to blame? And if you can continue on your theme, you're saying it's still, even with that, and with the lack of progressive labor laws that facilitate organization and unionization, it really is much more of an internal problem. The nature of organized labor as dealing with things with complete complacency?
I don't want to fix blame on the leaders. The leaders are, you know, who they are. I mean, they're basically, by and large, people who are making too much money, cuddling up too much to the employers. They are, in many ways, settled in as a bureaucracy, just like the rest of the bureaucracies in the corporate and public workplaces. The major problem we have is not to play cowboys and devils. You know, that's not the issue. The issue is that there's not a left today. There's not a left in the labor movement that's willing to make the fight and call the shot that needs to be called. And what we need is an organization in the labor movement and out of the labor movement that's willing to agitate, to fight, and to make a whole new beginning to what I think has become a corrupt labor movement in the traditional sense of the mob, but as you called it, a complacent labor movement, generally speaking. And even now when they're being attacked, with some very few exceptions, they don't yell and they don't scream and they don't raise hell. And that's because they have become, to a large extent, the best of them, sense of defeat. Now, the Canadian organization called Socialist Project, today, this is their Labor Day message, was in Canada, they need a new Labor Party, politically. That's part of the story. You can't continue to support the Democrats. I mean, it's not going to work. I mean, even when you have a progressive Democrat like Elizabeth Warren, for example, she has now come out for the State of Israel, saying that they are almost blameless for what has been going on in the Middle East. And if the Hamas continues to throw rockets, then the Israelis have to take, and the Americans have to support them, to take direct action in the form of bombings and so on. At a time when the Israelis announced that they're claiming 1,000 acres of land in the West Bank. I'm just giving you one example. But, you know, but in terms of the fight that needs to take place, even within the country, this country, without regard to foreign policy, Tell me, in the state, in the city of New York, I'm not challenging you. This is a rhetorical question. Which of the unions, with one exception, I know, 1180 of CWA, has said, look, we have a housing crisis. Working people cannot afford to live here anymore. They have to work here because this is where the jobs are in New York, as such as they exist. But we need a housing program. And when de Blasio, who they all supported, now says he's accepting the 80% luxury housing and 20% affordable housing formula, which is what the contractors have actually proposed, we haven't got any voices anymore. This is really the issue. And let's take the issue of education. That's part of the story. I'm not just talking about the workplace. But our kids, that is to say, working people's kids, are being screwed over by an educational system which is basically broken. And we haven't had a real labor response to that because most of working people's kids go to public schools. They don't go to private schools, and the private schools are not so hot, but they go to public schools which are overcrowded, where the rooms are not properly repaired, where the buildings are falling apart, where the money is not there for decent conditions. We have a teachers' union which is now beginning to wake up, just beginning to wake up, the AFT, the UFT, but it says virtually nothing except we're being attacked and we have to fight back.
Since you've mentioned housing, you've mentioned education. One of the things that I was delighted about and haven't seen for a long, long time in terms of organized labor taking up the very lives of the working class, of the workers, where they live and what they identify with and how they're being attacked. And that is the UFT actually participated in the march in Staten Island around the death of Eric Garner.
That's been
some of the most effective organizing in the history of organized labor when there were groups like RAM, the Revolutionary Auto Movement, and DRUM, Detroit Revolutionary Union Movement, where they identified with the oppression of people of color, where there was identification with women's issues. Is that part of what we're talking about and what's really missing?
Absolutely. And you know, one of the problems with Staten Island, with the Garner, I am delighted that the UFT actually joined the march. That goes without saying, because there's so much now under siege. That's why I think they're doing it, not because they understand what the issues are, frankly. But I don't care whether they understand. They're taking a good position. However, you can't be talking about one-day marches anymore. What happened in Ferguson is really a model that has to be continued, or what happened in Occupy in 2011 has to be learned, which is you stay in the streets. You stay in the streets. You don't have a one-day march. You stay in the streets. You don't stop. You don't say, now we've done our symbolic act, and now we're going to go back to work on Monday morning. We're going to have a Labor Day parade on Saturday. What that means is, to a large extent, on September 6th, which is a Saturday, unions are going to march on a Labor Day parade, but they won't do it on a Monday, which would mean that people would have to take the day off and really amounts to a general strike. No, we're not going to do that. We're going to do it on Saturday, which is perfectly safe, and we're going to have a meeting with the police, and the police will tell us where to march, where the line of march is. We're going to be going under the supervision of the police, just like it's been happening before. Now, that's a very different perspective. And I think the problem at this point is that nobody's willing to take the lessons of the Black Freedom Movement, which was you had to engage in acts of civil disobedience. You had to engage in acts of mass protest as took place in Ferguson. In Staten Island, they're not marching every day. Now, don't misunderstand me. It's a good thing that the UFT joined, but it is not necessarily going to mean much.
Stanley, you mentioned general strike and you mentioned Occupy, but the closest we've come in the last few years to anybody even talking about a general strike was in Madison, Wisconsin, during the uprising there. But that was translated into political action. Why don't you talk a little bit about what happened there and why that didn't work?
Well, I mean, what happened with Occupy... Let me first say thing. What's happening in Ferguson is what happened in Wisconsin and indirectly with Occupy. In Ferguson and in Wisconsin, what the movement has decided and did decide is that they would transform their activity from direct action in the street to voter registration and to, in the case of Wisconsin, to the recall of the state legislatures on the governor. Electoral activity is not where it's at today. I mean, it's still, if you had a political party that really represented working people in a serious way, you might want to engage in that. But the truth of the matter is that to take direct action and put it in an electoral perspective is a mistake. And I think the problem at this point is that what happened in Occupy is that they didn't have a strategy beyond what they did. That is to say, to take a certain degree of public space. They did not have, finally, a series of demands, which I don't think they were wrong to deny at the beginning, but they did not have, they went into such a thing as defending the people who had foreclosures, and they didn't follow through. They didn't build a national network, a national organization, or even, for that matter, in most cases, a local organization that could take on the issue of housing, to take on the issue of the foreclosures, to take on questions of education. The problem is,
or even unemployment,
a symbolic act, and it was worthwhile for when it lasted, but then it worked itself down out, and it was gone.
Another element that I want to bring in really is from your book, which again is The Death and Life of American Labor. And there's a significant chapter on the underlying failure of organized labor, technology, and the changing face of production. And if you could bring that into the picture as another element that really is relevant to what is happening, and I think the forms that organizing need to take to advance the interests of the working class.
Thank you very much, Mimi. I think you hit the... thank you for reminding me. In my book, which will be out on October the 7th, I say the underlying failure of American labor, the underlying failure, apart from its, what I've just said, is its refusal to address seriously the problem of technological displacement and the permanent unemployment that it means. We are now in a period of so-called recovery in which whatever they call job recovery is mainly, you know, part-time, temporary, and contingent labor. That the fact is that that technology has not been, genuinely speaking, technology has not genuinely benefited working people. It has displaced them, put them on unemployment lines, and put them in part-time jobs and low-paying jobs. Technology is not our friend. Now, there are people who say, and I raise this in the book, I say people who say, well, you know, we've organized Occupy by the Internet, we've organized by social media, a number of different protests, and that is all true. But at the same time, what really technology is fundamentally about is the elimination of labor. Now, I'm not saying that you're going to eliminate technology. That was not my argument. My argument is that the labor movement has to raise the question, do we not have the right to negotiate over the question of the introduction of technology into the workplace? Do we not have the right to negotiate the introduction of technology into education? So, for example, I raised the issue of long-distance learning, of courses on the Internet. Do we not have the right to address the problem of the relationship between technology and the way in which power and surveillance of working people at their workplace, as well as political activists everywhere, has really acted to restrain serious protests and serious organization. We don't really have a line, and we don't really have an analysis collectively of what technology is and isn't. There are certain virtues of technology, but largely, I think, it's been left to the corporations. It's been left to the state to operate, and we are only in a position of reaction. And because we're only in a position of reaction and not of genuine intervention, I think we've lost a tremendous amount of ground.
Stanley, the one place in the American labor movement that seems to have some kind of movement is organizing among low-wage workers, especially fast food workers. And that involves a different kind of organizing, especially based in the community sector. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah. I think it was really important that the United Food and Commercial Workers in Walmart, the service employees in the fast food restaurants, took an initial step to try to call attention to low-wage labor. And it did have a tremendous impact, I think, on the West Coast and in some other places where the $15 an hour minimum wage has now become a real issue. I don't deny the importance of that. The problem, as far as I can tell, and I think I'm pretty accurate about this, is that there's no continuity. There's no strategy within the unions that did the initial action of striking. And they'll do it another time, I suppose, on one-day strikes or, 24-hour strikes and so on. There's no strategy for organizing. There's no attempt to raise some very serious problems if you really wanted to raise them, which is that, for the sake of argument, if you really wanted to organize in McDonald's or you really wanted to organize in Burger King or Wendy's or any of the other chains, how would you do that? Would you organize on a regional basis? Would you, if you went for elections, and I'm not saying the NLRB is perfect, but if you went for an NLRB election, would you have to insist that the real bargaining unit is a single McDonald's store or at least a regional store? The problem is I don't hear them talking seriously, strategically. I hear them talking protest and resistance. And unless they talk about strategy, until they talk about an alternative way of organizing to the traditional way of organizing, on the one hand. On the other hand, it's good that they've called attention to the fact that low-wage workers are low-wage and that it is really good, not good enough anymore. I think that's a very important contribution that the unions have made. But until they really carry that message step or two further, they're not really talking about organizing the unorganized.
And one of the other things that we just skimmed through, and I want to go back to, was what it really means to organize within the context of a union and what rank and file unionism is about. The struggle for union reform, which is a whole chapter in your book. And I do want you to bring that out because we have ceded our union structures, which I think is very much part of the problem, to a hierarchy.
That's right.
It's a kind of democratic centralism with mostly centralism and no democracy.
Not much anyway.
And I think that has everything to do with engrossing the working class and elaborating and building on the consciousness. It almost reminds me of, when I was the director of organizing of the Sportswear Joint Board of the ILGWU, the way we got people to go to the meetings is we gave them, and let me tell you, it was pretty good stuff, huge shopping bags full of cold cuts. People came to the union meeting and they walked away with pastrami. They certainly didn't walk away with any consciousness, and they weren't permitted to really have a structure and an input that took up the issues that were strategic to their concerns. Is that part of what you think the problem is?
Well, yes. You referred to a chapter of my book which talks about union reform. I think the union reform movement to fight for more democracy within the unions is a part of the story. It's part of the puzzle. But I think the union reform movement, even the best, the Teamsters for a Democratic Union, for example, the old steelworkers rank and file, what happened to them is that they still lived within the context of contract unionism. They still thought that collective bargaining and a better union, a more democratic union, was the answer to the problems of the working class. And I think that that's always been a part of the problems of the working class. But the other part of the working class is that a workers' movement has to be built both within and outside the unions. That is to say, for the sake of illustration, and I'm going to go back to where I started, the Metropolitan Council on Housing, the rent strike movement of the 1964-65 period, which included organizations in East Harlem and in Bedford-Stuyvesant and in the Lower East Side and other places, that's part of the workers' movement. We don't think, when we think about the workers' movement, we got to think beyond the unions. The unions have to be part of it, but they're not the whole part of it. That's one issue. The second issue is really important, really, and this is the hard one. And that is that collective bargaining may or may not be the best strategy for achieving what workers need. Now, I would argue, for example, that the Taxi Workers Alliance, and I talk about this in the book, that the Taxi Workers Alliance, which has no contracts, has been a very effective organization. It's got 15,000 members. There, you know, we could argue whether it's all true or not, but it's a substantial group of people, of taxi cab workers, and they don't. It's not really. It's not a union. It started as a workers' center, and it makes its fight on the basis of direct action and more or less informal negotiations with the Taxi and Limousine Commission without a contract. And we have to be prepared in the case of fast food. We have to be prepared in case of most low-wage workers, domestic workers, for example, to not look to contracts as the answer to workers' needs. It may be in some cases that the fight itself, the strikes and the demonstrations and the occupations and the agitation that is needed will not result in a contract or a union within the meaning of the law, the National Labor Relations Law Act or state labor relations, but will actually be much closer to what the industrial workers of the world, the IWW, faced in the 19 period from 1905 to about 1920, which is that they made the fight, and when they won or lost the fight, then they went home and for the next fight. But now what we have is the contract becomes a noose, and that noose, in my judgment, is one that's getting more tightly wrapped around the labor movement's neck. And I think it's a mistake.
We have about a minute left, and I do want to encourage people to read The Death and Life of American Labor Towards a New Labor, Towards a New Workers' Movement. Stanley, how do we get that noose off? What are some of the elemental steps that we have to take to make sure that rising again happens with the working class?
I think what we need to first, I mentioned in the book the organization that the Communist Party established in the 1920s called the Trade Union Education League. And what the Trade Union Education League was an organization outside of the unions that pressured the unions from the outside and also organized sometimes independently resistance against wage cuts and against low wages and all that, mainly in the textile industry, the mining industry, and the lumber industry. We need an organization of bringing together the radical and the militant workers who are both in the unions and can form their own organizations. The second thing we need is that we need that organization and within the unions to agitate for the fight for taking into account workers' total needs, which is about education, it's about health, it's about the environment, it's about their workplace, it's about democratizing the unions. And we can't simply become another what is called a syndicalist organization inside the workplace. I think it's both necessary but not adequate. The second thing we need, as I've said more in other places, is we need a political party of labor. And a political party of labor may be a socialist party, may be a communist party, but it's got to be a party that has, and I use the word party, it's not an electoral instrument primarily, but it's a party that would, with the Trade Union Education League concept, not necessarily the name, would actually be a force in the country to begin to address the questions of class and class struggle. And if we can do that much, which is not small, then we have a beginning. Then the unions might change, as they did in the 1930s. The political environment might change. The Democratic Party itself might feel the heat. But it's not going to feel the heat largely by people subordinating themselves to it, either by putting their money or their energy into it.
Stanley Aronowitz is indeed the most important scholar on the past and present U.S. working class. And you've certainly fanned my flames. You've fired me up, can't take no more. And you've given us some real food for thought and directions to move in.
Thank you very much.
There's a lot more in this book than Stanley covered right now. There's a lot more new ideas and new interpretations. Get the book, Death and Life of American Labor, Toward a New Workers' Movement, by Stanley Aronowitz.
I can feel the spirit building, soft as a whisper, but loud as a roar. I can feel something a-stirring, like
and we are going to rise again. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.